The kindest, gentlest man I ever knew was my great uncle Arthur. By the time I knew him, he was well into his 70s and he was still working as a gardener. In fact, he works as a gardener until shortly before his death in his 80s. And that was all rather amazing because he was blind, or nearly blind. And he used to grow the most amazing roses, which he told me he pruned by touch. Nothing like commitment to your work. He'd grown up in a country estate in Rutland. His father had been a farmhand on this vast landed estate. And he left school, Arthur did, at the age of 12, which ought to get some of the younger ones of you slightly worried, to also work on the estate. Him in the stables. It turned out he had a natural gift with horses. He was able to calm them and understand them. And soon he was not only breaking in new horses to the estate, but teaching the younger members of the family to ride and given other responsibilities. In due course, that newfangled invention, the motor car, was introduced. And he worked out how it worked and was able to take it apart and fix it on the many occasions it went wrong. And then the First World War broke out. And pretty soon it was realized that Britain's army simply wasn't big enough for the task in hand. And a new one, much larger, was needed. As with all the other young men on the estate, he went to the nearest town and volunteered. There he was, an expert horseman, a competent mechanic, and so of course they put him in the infantry. He trained and was eventually sent to France, where much to his frustration, there was even more training and more training before eventually they were sent to forward positions. They rotated to the very front lines, but it was quiet and he saw no action, much to his relief, but he said also to his disappointment before they were again withdrawn to train again. When they returned to the front lines, it was in the midst of the most terrible barrage humanity had ever seen. They were told their attack would be simple. It would be quite literally a walkover. Indeed, they were ordered to walk. But when the morning came and they were lined up in the trench, he admitted to the sergeant standing near him, he was terrified and he didn't know if he could do it. And the sergeant, and maybe this is uncharacteristic, you can tell me later, was very understanding and gentle with him. He said, all you have to do is climb up to the top of that ladder, face forward, and take a step. And when you've taken that step, take one more and count them. And when you get to 200, your job will be done. So the whistle went. He climbed the ladder. He took his step. And then the next. And when he got to 6, his war was over as a shell exploded near him, and that was the end. He'd never seen his enemy close up. He'd never fired an aimed shot at them. And yet he'd done his duty. And we've come here today to remember all those who did their duty, whether they are the bemedaled heroes or the ones who played a quieter part. Some of you, of course, because of recent events, will have a personal memory of losing a member of your own family or friend. But for most of us, such as myself, it's an inherited memory passed on from one generation to the next. It's 103 years since the armistice at the end of that war was signed. 101 years since the cenotaph in London was unveiled. It's marking the unveiling of many similar, including our own. And 100 years since the Royal British Legion began its important work. These things are part of an ever more distant history, but for millions of people since then, war has not been history, but a very real part of their lives. In recent years, within the memories of even the youngest here today, members of our armed forces have fought and died in the conflicts of Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. leaving yet more friends and families grieving. So how do we understand a war? So often we hear and read about the numbers of deaths and injured, the length of campaigns, the number of guns and missiles, the size of the Navy, the Army, the Air Force. Perhaps the numbers speak to us of the scale of the conflict. But I suggest that such statistics have little, if any, relevance to those who have lost a son or a daughter, a brother or a sister, a father or a mother. We've just stood outside as once again we've heard the names of members of this community who have died in conflict. And of course, there are others also. It's unlikely that you will know who each person was. The names written on our cenotaph and on the board at the back of this church. And maybe if you read them, they will remain just names to you. But they can no longer be simply numbers. Maybe if you read that list, you'll recognize some surnames, names carried by people living in this community today. Maybe a name carried by you. And they should and will each be remembered by their names. Because it is eternally important that we remind ourselves of the dreadful cost of war if we are ever to live in a meaningful peace. The most compelling outward sign of our remembrance is the simple red flower, the Flanders poppy. It has become the symbol of the Royal British Legion. But more than that, across the world, it has come to represent the sacrifice made by all those men, women, and children who gave their lives in conflict. From early history, flowers have become symbols. The clover leaf for the Holy Trinity of Christianity. Lilies for purity. Roses for love and for England. Daffodils for the Marie Curie charity and for Wales. The thistle for Scotland and shamrock for Ireland. And many others besides. But how was the poppy chosen as the universal symbol of remembrance? It began with a death. The death of a friend of a man called John McCrae, who was serving in Belgium in 1915. And John McCrae was kneeling at the grave of his friend and was moved to write a poem reflecting the scene around him as he remembered. And he wrote this. In Flanders fields the poppies blow between the crosses row on row that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard among the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. McCrae didn't like the poem he'd just written, and so he threw it to one side. But one of his fellow officers found it and was so touched that he sent it to England, where it was published and soon widely known. And as a result, that poppy quickly became the symbol for those who have served and died in battle. In 1921, the Royal British Legion began the Poppy Day appeal to raise money for poor and disabled veterans and for their families. And now that is probably their most well-known activity. It continues to raise funds needed to help all service men and women and their families in the most practical of ways. However, critically, the appeal serves to maintain our awareness of our past and of also, of course, of our present. In order that our prayers and efforts for peace and the future of our families and our children and grandchildren may be better fulfilled. The Bible records much violence, many wars and countless deaths, especially in the Old Testament. And it's a heartbreaking reflection that there have probably never been a time when conflict has not existed somewhere on this planet. Jesus himself was born into an occupied land, and he lived and died in that land. His people, the Jews, were waiting for their king, their Messiah, who they expected to overthrow the Roman invaders by the traditional violent means. And for many, Jesus was so disappointing. For peace was not on the agenda in those New Testament times. Yet Jesus came and taught peace to the disciples and anyone who would listen to him. And he said, as we heard a few minutes ago, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the sons and daughters of God." That message didn't suit the Pharisees and many religious leaders, because he threatened the status quo. And anyhow, he didn't fit their idea of the anticipated mighty and all-conquering Messiah. The local Roman authorities were worried about that any unrest would reflect badly on them. In fact, Pontius Pilate's career was later ruined by these events. They wanted a quiet life. Peace on the terms, their terms, was just fine. So Jesus, the light of the world, died for all in an act of darkest violence. Yet 3 days later, as the Son of God, he rose again as light for us all. Peace is the most precious of commodities. It springs from trust, patience, tolerance, and faith. It is not unilateral. It cannot be peace only on my terms, but it comes from mutual agreement and understanding. Peace has never been easy to achieve. It is hard work to establish and keep the peace at any level in our society. Yet regardless of the difficulties, peace must be what we all strive for. It is what Jesus taught. But the driving force for peace must come from us. It must come from our remembrance of those who have given so much in war and in service. It must come from those injured and changed by conflict, and from their families and loved ones who must soldier on. Peace will not come if we forget. It won't last if we wait for others to work for it. It's through our vigilance, our voice, and our prayers that peace and light will emerge and remain. The poppy wreaths and the crosses that we've laid at the memorial today, not only for those from this community who have given their lives, but from all the other communities that we know and have touched our lives. And we also remember the injured and their families, for whom there is no equivalent list of names. The poppy is our symbol of remembrance. But let us remember, through the remembering of pain and loss, that there is also the light of hope, love, and faith. Amen.